This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and we've got a pretty powerful story for you today from author, resiliency coach, body image advocate, Marcy Warhaft, who has written a very compelling, mesmerizing, brutally honest, and sometimes shocking memoir called, and here it is, The Good Stripper, a soccer mom's memoir of lies, loss, and lap dances. And I'm going to be honest with you all. At first, I wasn't sure if Marcy's book was right for our show, the right fit, because I thought the concept might be a little bit too racy and maybe even a little too X-rated for this program. And I think she sensed this without ever us having that conversation. And she was nodding as I was saying all of this. So I know I was right. But I finally relented because I realized that part of bliss is surviving trauma, abuse, tragedy, and even self-destructive behaviors that may be beyond our control. And the strength and courage to overcome all of that is really where the bliss is. And Marcy Warhaft possesses that strength and resiliency, which I think she's always had since she was a little kid. As one of your relatives says, you talk about in the book that you've always had that strength and courage and resiliency. And in the book, Marcy Warhaft shares in raw, honest, and very intimate detail her eye-popping journey to self-discovery. Her book is dedicated to anyone who may be struggling to forgive themselves for mistakes they made or for what they tolerated when they were just doing their best to survive. Marcy is a recognized expert on body image and self-esteem and was named one of Canada's top 100 health influencers. Marcy is using her life experiences to help others release shame from their past and move forward with the happiness they deserve. Marcy, welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
I am so happy to be here and to chat with you. Thank you.
First of all, congratulations on the book. It really is a compelling, riveting, and powerful page turner. It's pretty disturbing at times. It's shocking, but it's also so honest and authentic, and a very authentic look at a life that you've had that has been full of trauma, tragedy, upheaval, and tremendous heartache. And ultimately, it's one of triumph. You really spent years living a double life, packing school lunches by day, doing never-ending carpools with a smile on your face, holding back the tears till the kids were out of the car, and then giving lap dances by night, which you're not doing anymore, but you did for some time. We'll talk about that. And before we take a deep dive into the book, can you just tell our listeners briefly about your brainchild, The Good Stripper, a soccer mom's memoir of lies, loss, and lap dances?
Sure. So again, thank you for reading it, because I know the title can be, for some people, it's very exciting and tantalizing. And for other people, it could be off-putting because it sounds like it's a stripper's tale. Nothing wrong with that, but that's not my story. I only danced actually for a short period of time. The double life went on for years. But the book I wrote, never thought I'd write it, never thought I'd be able to write it. I wrote it when I was 49 years old, realizing that I had more years behind me than ahead of me. I realized that I was somebody who never felt that they could really fit in. I never felt like I fit in. Every time, every group, everything in my life, I never quite fit. I never felt like I lived up to other people's expectations. I never felt like I was worthy of happiness, of anything. And I think what changed that was I realized that the reason why I wasn't fitting in anywhere was because I wasn't being my true self. Because I was holding back, because I was carrying shame and guilt over things I had done in the past. Mm-hmm. And you can't find your place if you're not you. Mm-hmm. And I reached a point turning 50 where I thought, when am I going to be me? When am I going to just let the world see me and let the chips fall where they may kind of thing? And it was now. And I decided for me, the answer was release all that guilt, the shame by exposing your secrets. I let go of everything that was holding me back and holding me hostage. And I was so terrified of people finding out who I was. And I decided no more fear. I was going to let everyone know who I was. If people loved me, they loved me. If they didn't, they didn't. If they stayed, if they left, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. It was time for me to be me. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wrote the book.
I have to tell you, it's also very well written. Like when I say that it's a page turner, it's compelling, but it's very easy to read. It's very beautifully written. It's very evocative. There's an amazing scene much later on in the book where you're looking in the mirror and you have your epiphany, where you realize I'm all of these things. I'm good. I'm all of it. But you actually see who you really are. And I want people to read it to know that paragraph, but it's quite powerful because it's that moment. I think everyone has that moment where they kind of look at themselves. You know, I know you were an actor, so you'll understand this. I know that you went to the Dome Theater in Montreal, and I know it was not for the full time, but I know that school very well. And it's almost like there's the proscenium arch. There you are. You see the picture. And you saw it. And that was very powerful. And I know that's much later on, but I just found that to be a very compelling scene of honesty and truth. And you realizing, wait a minute, things have to change.
Absolutely. I think that's the problem with a lot of us is that we see ourselves in one way. And a lot of the times it's not a positive way. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter how many successes we've had, we'll focus on our failures. It doesn't matter how much we've survived, we focus on the struggle. I think that we see the negativity. And so especially if we feel like we've made mistakes, we can't see what we've overcome. Mm-hmm. So when we look at ourselves, we'll see those flaws, those self-perceived flaws. Mm-hmm. And I think in that moment, and I remember that day very vividly. I mean, I just been crying and I had to get myself together and get my kids from school. And I looked at myself and I saw all of the women that I was and had been. I saw all of the parts of me. I saw the little girl who was feisty and strong and wanted to take over the world. I did see the woman who crumbled, who had been hurt and betrayed. But I also saw that there was this strength in me that was still there because you don't lose who you are. You know, my mother used to always say, people don't change, they modify. Mm. So who you are at your core is who you are. Life can change you, but it doesn't completely change you at your core. It modifies, you learn. And I was able to sort of see the full picture, even if it was in brief, it was enough for me to see a light. I had seen so much darkness behind me that at that moment, seeing all of who I was and knowing there was so much more to me than the times I had fallen, I was able to see, wait a second, I also picked myself up. And that was what gave me the strength to know that I could do it again.
And you had to pick yourself up many times. And I write that you share all of the punishing circumstances and the self-destructive behaviors that shaped your early adulthood. And you really reveal it all for everyone to read. There are times where I thought, this is fiction. This didn't really happen, but it did. It really, really did happen to you. So what ultimately gave you the courage to expose it? And it's so interesting when I'm using the word expose and make yourself vulnerable, because I'm using it a bit of as a double entendre, because you did do this. It's a little tongue in cheek, but you did expose something far more than your body. You exposed your truest, innermost vulnerable self. Was that scary? Was it something you went back and forth on a million times? Or was there just a liberating notion at a certain point that said, well, if I do this, I don't have to keep hiding?
All of the above. I think when I was writing it, I felt like if I was going to write it, I was going to write it. I was going to write it. And I couldn't hold back the stuff that made me look bad. I couldn't hold back the stuff that was embarrassing, because then what am I doing? Mm-hmm. Then that's not me being authentic, and not to throw around that word that's used so much, but if I was going to do it, I was going to do it. And I can't write a book about releasing shame if I'm still holding on to some. And if I was going to hold back the things that I thought, people are going to really judge me for, then it's a lie. And that's not what this is about. This is about being as honest and truthful as I can be, because that's what's been liberating for me. So was it scary? Oh my God, it was scary. But there was also something very, once you take that, that leap, I mean, there were times, I will be very honest, I remember physically writing things and taking my hands up going, oh my God, can I say that? I don't know if I can say that. Should I say that? Right. I'm like, I'm going to say it and see what happens, because I would shock myself. And even now, if I'll read through certain parts, I kind of go, wow, I said that.
Oh my God.
But I had to, that's just me. I'm sort of a go big or go home kind of gal. So and the interesting thing though, Judy, is writing is one thing. So you write it. Knowing it's going to be published, okay, that's another thing. Yes. Like, okay. But then once it is published,
It's out there.
And once people say, when they say, I ordered your book, I'm like, that's great. And then I think, you're going to learn a lot about me. Or I read your book, or, you know, I was at my gym the other day and two women working there said, we're reading your book. And I'm like,
What has been the reaction, would you say? And I'm sure you've heard many things, but what has been the general reaction?
Amazing. Honestly, amazing. And I did not know what to expect. I put it out there and I just kind of held on and thought, okay, let's see what happens. I did not know. I really didn't know if people were going to shun me, if people were going to just turn their backs on me. I didn't know. I was ready. I couldn't have done it before I did it. I was at a point in my life where I was ready for whatever happened because I was okay with me for the first time in my life. But I did not expect to have people who I didn't know, people from all over the world, people messaging me saying, oh my God, I'm not alone in this. Or wow. people will share things with me that they still haven't told anybody because they know that A, I'm not going to judge. Right. And they know that they can just innately trust me. But even if the details of my story aren't the same as yours, because a lot of them aren't going to be the same, there's the themes of loss and betrayal and self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Those things are universal.
Absolutely.
And we can relate. And I think that I've had so many people kind of take me aside and that I didn't even know, read it and say, you know, certain parts were a bit triggering and they had to put the book down.
Yeah.
And they had to process
decompress.
It, go through their stuff
yeah.
and then pick it up again. Yeah. And I understand that. And it's because when I wrote it, the tough part is certain parts of my story I had shared before. Some of them I did not. A lot of them I had not shared, but certain parts of my losses I had, but I had told them in a way that you almost build emotional scar tissue mm-hmm. when you tell a story so many times and you can tell it without feeling it. Mm-hmm. If I was going to write this book, I needed to feel it because I wanted people to feel what I was feeling in those moments. And so I had to open that scar tissue. So I had to go back into those moments and feel them again. And that was tough, but that's what enabled me to connect with other people. And that's been a gift.
Was it a difficult process to write or did it write itself? I just interviewed a songwriter who said one of my favorite songs that she wrote in one sitting. Was it that kind of vibe? Like you spent a month or a couple of weeks and it just all came out of you? Or was it more laborious? Like how would you describe the writing process?
I wrote the whole book in about 7 months. Before I sent it out to the publisher. And I mean, it's all I did. It was really, once it's in my head, you can't turn it off. I think what was interesting was that there were memories that, because people say, how do you remember so much? And what happens is once you remember certain things, you sort of unlock that. Mm-hmm. It leads to another memory and then another memory. So things just kind of came. But I will say, and I've shared this, that there are certain chapters that I did not want to stay in for more than a day.
Right.
It was really, really emotionally and then physically taxing. I mean, I felt it in my bones that I would write straight through the night.
Wow.
I would write until the morning because I just could not be in that place. And now I would be better with it because it just, again, I've had time. I've worked through it. Writing it helped me work through it, but working through it and opening up that, mm-hmm. that scar tissue, it was tough, but it was pretty quick. I think it had been in there for so long.
You wanted to release it. Did it feel liberating and cathartic when you did it, when you finished it? Or was it like, uh-oh, what have I done?
Well, I didn't have a what have I done thing. It's kind of like, oh, this is what I do. Like, this is okay. I'm ready. But there were parts that were definitely cathartic. But again, it's like I said, when there were so many years of trauma that I was writing up until I end the book when I was about 46. And so going through all of that trauma and writing it in 7 months, I was like, I didn't even realize how much it was. I had back pain. Like it was affecting me in ways that I'm putting myself through it again.
Right, right.
But the cathartic part really did come from writing certain parts where I was able to look at things in my life from a different perspective, things that I still felt guilty about. As I was writing it, I went, oh, Wait a minute. Now I know why I thought that. Now I know what that made. And I was able to forgive myself.
Amazing.
So it was the forgiveness that came from the writing it that was so liberating.
That's huge. That's such a great thing for anyone out there who's writing a memoir or a journal or wants to write a book that is a little bit nonfiction, is just to be aware of that piece that even though it may be difficult, there's an element of forgiveness that's going to come and peace and letting go and all of that stuff. It's not just cathartic, wow, I did it. It actually might help you deal with it. So it's a wonderful sort of actionable step that you can take, to use the life coaching sort of word, to help yourself. So I just want to go back for a moment to your childhood, because there's just so much, like I didn't realize until, of course, I read this, that there's so much that led to all of this. This wasn't like, this didn't just all happen that, you know, you went from soccer mom to lap dancer. Like this was, exactly. This was a whole journey in the making. You had a beloved older brother, Billy, 5 years your senior, who really was like a hero to you and was your best friend and your protector and your everything. And there's some beautiful sections in the book where you talk about him and your relationship and all the things he did for you at summer camp and everywhere that made you feel so loved. And at a very young age, he was taken from you. And I'm so sorry about the loss of your brother. Yeah. And you found this out in such a difficult way when the principal came into your classroom during one of your final exams in high school and asked you to go to the office. And you weren't the type that was ever asked to go to the office. And you knew there was something scary happening. Can you take us back to that day and tell us what happened?
Yeah, that was probably one of the toughest chapters to write. It was one of the first chapters I wrote, actually. And it's the toughest one for me to read. Still, it's one of the toughest ones. You know, I lost my brother in 1987 when I was 17. Wow. And people will say to me, how did you get over it? And I say, I'll let you know.
I'm not.
When it happens. Yeah. Because I'm not. I mean, losing my brother and my mother. I mean, these are things I'll never quite get over. But I also feel very, very lucky that I had an older brother like that. My father was out of the picture from when I was 10. And my brother really, well, I guess I looked at him the way little girls are supposed to look at their fathers, I guess, you know. To me, I was feisty and I would argue with anyone, but like he, to me, could say anything. And I just thought he was the star and the sun and the moon. Because he was loving and warm and funny.
Kind.
And he was my protector. I say all the time, he knew when to stand in front of me to protect me. And he knew when to stand behind me, teaching me how to take care of myself. Yeah. And that was a great combination. I say this in the book, you know, he was my invisible armor that I wore out in the world.
You know,
he made me feel safe.
You know, actions make characters like that. There's so many images that are so powerful. And one of them is when you were at summer camp and you were named Miss Grey Cup. That's like being Miss America. And you were Miss Grey Cup and you were much younger than him. And he marched onto the stage and lifted you up onto his shoulders. Like that just shows who he was. And I really got what that relationship was from images like that.
Absolutely. I mean, he was my, you know, when I was 10, I don't even mention the book, my best friend's father passed away and I got really scared. Death really scared me. And I remember that summer at camp, I was 8. And so he was what, 13? And I remember crying a lot and I would go to his cabin and, you know, another big brother would have been like, ugh, leave me alone. But he would just take me in and he would hug me. And
wow.
He was so supportive that, yeah. So it's losing him, I will have to say, not my parents' divorce, not other things. That was the first thing that really completely changed the course of my life, was his loss, 100%.
And I'm so sorry about that. And I'm so sorry about the loss of your mother, which happened a little later, but your mother died very young of cancer. And you also had a very, very, very close relationship. And you were there for her. She was there for you. You were inextricably tied together. And so that was another terribly painful loss that happened a little bit later. And I'm very sorry about that as well. And as you mentioned, your parents were divorced when you were 10. You had this stepfather who also basically was leading a double life. And he had the whole world convinced that he was Mr. Charming, nice guy, fabulous person, everything. When in fact, he actually went to jail for committing 47, correct me if I'm wrong, 47 bank robberies. 47 yeah. Bank robberies. And so here there's all this upheaval in your childhood. But it was also, I think, what I sort of read between the lines is what is real, what isn't, which must have been what's good, what's bad, which must have been very confusing and scary for a young girl. How do you think your stepfather's deception impacted your view of men and of what was real and what wasn't, what was right and wrong in life?
That's a tough question to answer in a way. I don't know. There was so much happening at that time too. That year, I have to say, I mean, you look at, my brother died in 1987. He was arrested in 1988.
Oh my God.
So those were two huge things. And then my mother, just a few months after that, was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Wow.
So that was a lot. And I had just, when Billy died, I developed an eating disorder. So I was dealing with huge things. I mean, we're talking, I look back and think I was 17. Wow. One of these things is enough to completely shatter you, but all of these things. Mm-hmm. So I think, well, that is why the eating disorder started, right? Because the world seemed so scary And because, I mean, you look at something like my brother dying, which was, he wasn't, to me, he was strong and healthy. This wasn't something I was prepared for at all. So that was shocking. Mm-hmm. And then your step, I mean, now I kind of laugh and think, oh my God, it's such a crazy story. And he was a bank robber at the time. Not so funny, right. You know,
because
and
you developed a relationship with him. You had a relationship with him that was good by all intents and purposes.
There's trust. Right. That's the scary thing, I think. And that's why I'm so, for me to this day, I will forgive a lot. But you lied to me once and that's it, because it was looking at me with in my eyes and with detail telling me, because he said he was a caterer. Right. So telling me what he was cooking for the party that he was pretending to cater and taking me to, this is the market where I get my fish, like literally taking me to places where he didn't go. So to lie and then to have it be, and then I didn't see him. He'd gone to work and then I came back from school and Eddie's gone. Oh, he's in prison. He was arrested for bank. It's how do you, I could even really understand everything that was, it was just too much. Right. So I think that in that case, it impacts you in a way that you don't even, it went into me, into my core, yes, and changed me without me even realizing how much of an impact it was going to have later on.
This was crazy stuff. And around this time, there's so much, as you say, that was happening. You were accepted to the Dome Theater in Montreal, the theater school, and you didn't stay there. And I think ultimately there was just too much going on. What would you say was ultimately your decision to not continue? Because this was a very big thing to be accepted. You're a very good student. You were accepted into a very top-notch theater school. And I have a friend who went through that school, so I know it really well.
Great school.
So what happened? Like, was it just that all of these events happened together? And was it the eating disorder? Or was it just the loss and just all of it that was too much for you to take this seriously?
I think it was a combination. I mean, so Billy died at the end of May and then I go into the summer.
Yeah.
And also he was an actor in his high school. Yes. Actually, when he passed away, his high school created a theater library and named it after him. So yeah, he was a really good actor. And he had given me, my audition piece was a monologue from a play that he had done. Mm. So there was a lot of connection there. And I talk about in the book how the day that I got the call saying I had made it into the school.
You had just found out. He had just died.
So he just died. And I get the call that I got. And so I remember looking up at this guy and saying, thank you, Billy. But it was like, oh.
Yeah.
So there was a lot. And then I went to summer camp and I taught dance and came back. And then I had a terrible situation I talked about with the doctor who set me into this eating disorder.
Yes, I want to go back to the camp, because the camp thing was something that happened right after your brother passed away. And that was that you lost your virginity at camp and you were determined to. And what was interesting was all of your friends were doing other things. They were smoking cigarettes. They were smoking weed. They were drinking alcohol. They were doing all the things that a lot of teenagers do, which you, and I found it interesting, had made the decision not to do. You chose losing your virginity as your drug of choice. And I'm just wondering why you made this decision and weren't like, I know you already weren't like the other kids, but what was it about after Billy died, you feeling alone, parents being divorced, all of this stuff happening that made you make that choice?
Well, I did do some drinking. It was really once I started, just a few months later, that, yeah, I gave up. I didn't do any of that stuff. It's control. It was a control thing. Absolutely control. And I think, yeah, it was not a romantic kind of fairy tale thing for me. I went in there determined to lose my virginity. I think I was feeling very rebellious. Mm-hmm. I was not a rebellious kid. Like I said, I was feisty, but I was a good girl in a lot of ways. And I think I felt like, where did that get me? Mm-hmm. You know, being a good girl. Billy was good. Where did that get him? Mm-hmm. So I was kind of, it was my kind of like, I'm going to just be bad and see where that takes me. And again, it's control. So when you're 17 and you feel like you control nothing, I didn't have control over my life. I mean, you're a teenager. I saw when my brother died, well, okay, I really don't have control of what's going to happen. That's terrifying. What's the one thing that you can control? It's your body. That's it. That's the only thing that I have autonomy over. That's it. And so through food, through sex, these were ways that I could control. That I felt I could control. And it was me kind of also kind of saying, you know,
yes,
F this, everything. Yes. And just kind of try something different.
Before we hear more, we're going to go on a short commercial break. More with Finding Your Bliss and author Marcy Warhaft when we come back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
We're back. This is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, FM 96.7. And I'm here with author Marcy Warhaft. And we've been talking all about Marcy's journey towards self-acceptance and forgiveness. And I'd love to now just shift to talking about a huge part of your book, Marcy, which is your struggle with anorexia. This is a condition that plagues you for much of your teenage years, your adulthood, ending with a terrible bout of bulimia, hospitalizations, rehab, which on the final attempt in this final eating disorders group began to help you. But this is a huge part of the book. Your body image was so poor. Mm. And I think, as you say, it was a sense of control. And there's a breaking point. Like, I was shocked when I was reading that there was one period in the book where you were eating 3 apples in an entire day and water. And you would leave the living room, leave the couch to go eat these apples. Can you tell us what was happening at its worst? Oh. And what this was all about, because that was a part where I went, oh my God. And your bones were sticking out. You started out, I don't even know what you weighed, which was a normal weight. And you had this very problematic doctor say to you, oh, you're way overweight. And you lost 25 pounds and were like 100 pounds. You were in severe trouble. First of all, like the doctor, you don't say his name, but what was that all about? Mm-hmm. And can you just tell us about this whole period? Because this is a very big part of your life.
Yes, it is a big part. And it's funny because when you say, I'll go back, but when you say, what was the worst part? God, there were so, the part you talked about happened when I was about 20, and there were horrible parts that happened at 30 and 35. Mm. But with the doctor, it was such a devastating experience. And I don't blame him for my eating disorder. That came from the trauma. But I asked, he didn't start it, but he certainly encouraged it and kept it going because I was on a good path. When Billy went into the hospital, I thought, again, what's the one thing I can control? Food. What do people do when people are sick? You know, they bring food. When there's a funeral, they bring food. Everything's food. So I'm like, I'm not going to eat. And that's going to be my way of controlling something.
Wow.
And I saw myself getting obsessed with it. And then I went away to summer camp and I was teaching dance and I was surrounded by good people. And I felt, okay, you know what? I can do this. I can get a handle on this. I'm going to be okay with myself, which at 17 years old, I have to say, I look back and go, good for me, like to be able, it was the 80s. There wasn't a lot of talk about eating disorders like there are now. Mm-hmm. So for me to recognize it and then put an end to it, I was pretty proud of myself. Sure. Unfortunately, it didn't continue because I got back from camp and went to my GP for a physical. And he was, as you said, he was problematic. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is somebody who I told him very honestly, which isn't easy. I said, I saw myself getting obsessed with my weight. So please don't tell me what the number is. Now, I was a very fit. I spent the whole summer teaching dance. I've always been fit and healthy. It was not an issue. I knew for me, but it wasn't an issue. Right. And I was healthy.
Right.
But I knew. So I said, please don't tell me. And he looked at me and he said, oh, of course I'm going to tell you. And he kept pointing at my stomach and saying, look at you. What is that? Look at that. And if I were you, I wouldn't wear a bathing suit. And what he said, actually, he didn't say I was overweight. He said, medically speaking, you're not overweight, but society is very thin. And if you want to fit into society, you're going to have to lose 10 pounds.
So problematic. Oh my gosh. That would never fly. That would never fly now.
Are you kidding? Although I will tell you this, Judy, how about this? I got a message from somebody just a couple of weeks ago saying, was your doctor? And she gave me the name. And she said she had a similar experience. So this is something that's still going on.
You were, and I don't know if this was at the time of that period, but I read in the book that you were at one point working out from 2 to 5 a.m., the middle of the night.
Oh, that was later.
Later.
But, so, oh, I would.
But even that, like, I just thought, oh my God. So you were not sleeping, which is one of the pillars that we need, right? For health, 8 hours of sleep a night, 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And you were, can you explain the justification of what you were thinking to go work out from 2 to 5? Because you wanted to, I know this is when you had kids and you thought, I'm going to do it in the middle of the night and I'll be all fresh for school. And, but just the whole thinking of that, like what was going on in your brain?
Well, Judy, sleeping. I mean, that's so lazy. Who do you sleep? There's a whole, there's a whole other part of the day that you could be using. I mean, come on. I think it was two parts. So the working out in the middle of the night, A, when I started dancing, I did that because I really wanted to be home for my kids until they went to bed. And so I would tuck them in and then I would go dance and then I would come back and then I would go to the gym and then I would come back and have time to shower before being up with them again. So I didn't have time to sleep. So that's, I would go a couple of days without sleeping. The other part though, I belonged to 2 24-hour gyms because, as I say, one of them had the audacity to close at Christmas. And I think they closed early on Sundays. And it was this feeling of, what am I doing? I think I felt also I didn't deserve the rest. I didn't need the rest. I needed to prove my worth constantly. And if I wasn't always doing something, then I wasn't worthy. But it was fitting in the whole thing with body image stuff too. It's not a vanity thing. And I think people think that it is, you know, when it's such an insidious disorder. But I mean, I really felt like I needed to work off everything. I needed to look a certain way really, really hard. And that's why I talk about the one day I walked to my gym in the middle of the night, which was
dangerous.
Away.
And you were a mother at the time.
And
you still, of course, are a mother, but I'm saying this was when you were already a mother. And then you had that realization later on, wait a minute, what is something happened to me? How would, you know, my husband or anyone ever explain this to my children that at 4:30 in the morning, what was I doing
at
4:30 in the morning?
Why was I walking? Terrified.
It almost feels like your brain was not functioning properly, which is probably true because you weren't eating and you weren't.
I wasn't eating and I wasn't sleeping. But it's also, this is the thing with going back to the eating disorder for a minute, is that putting myself at risk by not sleeping, by walking to the gym an hour away at 1 o'clock in the morning, working out for 2 hours, walking back when there's nobody, as scary as it was, and I did think, oh my God, I'm putting myself in such a dangerous situation. But dying was less scary than gaining weight. I took a fat burner and was convinced that I was having a heart attack and thought, do I finish my workout or do I go to the gym? And then went to the, do I finish my workout or do I go to the hospital?
Right.
And then I went to the hospital and the doctor just thought I was an idiot and told me not to do that again. And I did it again. And it's this horrifying fear. You talked, and I'll go back to something you said earlier when I was only eating the 3 apples. That's, I was young. I just left school. I was living with my mom. And there was that night I talk about where I was sure I was dying, where I felt like my heart was slowing down. Like I felt like I could feel every beat slowing down. And I thought, I'm going to die tonight. And I thought, that's going to be horrible for my mom because she just lost a child. And I thought I should go into the kitchen and I should eat something. And then I thought, okay, but what if I'm not dying? And what if I eat something for nothing? And I didn't. And then I stayed up all night. And when the sun came up, I thought, okay, I made it. I'm okay.
I can do this
and
again.
That's how all encompassing this is. And you mentioned about how this was a sort of a theme. And it's because when Billy died and I felt like it should have been me instead of him, because I felt the world needed him more than it needed me, that started this whole thing of I'm not good enough. And I went through so much of my life feeling I'm not good enough. And when you do that, when you feel that, I wasn't, my mother was amazing. I mean, the way I saw my brother, she saw me. And as I saw her too, she was spectacular. So she did all the right things. But it was so embedded in me. It was just came from me that I felt that I would never be good enough. Wow. And when you feel that way, it leaves you so open and so vulnerable to so many things. And that's unfortunately what happened with me.
Well, and I just want to clear up for the listeners when you say, and you did the dancing in the middle of the night before, like you would do this way in the middle of the night, but you would put your kids to bed. So all day long, you would be a mom, packing lunches, doing carpool. I felt like you did a lot of carpool in the book and I related to that a lot because I did a lot of carpool too. And you did all this carpool and lunches and you were with your kids and you were with them every night for dinner. And then once they were safely tucked into bed and your husband was there to watch over them, you would go and you would work as a stripper in stripping clubs because mm-hmm. you felt, and I want you to explain this to us a little bit, but this allowed you to be a soccer mom by day and be a mom to your children, which was the most important thing in your life. When they went to bed, this was a way to make extra money. But I'm wondering what led to this decision? And did you ever feel scared or embarrassed or afraid of being caught or found out by other members of your community? And I'm just going to share this with the listeners that you had an alter ego that did the stripping named Cassidy, right? So,
right.
So, you know, you are Marcy by day. And then at night, your alter ego, Cassidy, would do this. But how were you able to rationalize all this? What was going through your mind? What made you do it? And can you tell us some of the things that led to you stripping at night? This is not something that I think okay. you ever thought when you got accepted into theater
no.
school.
No, I didn't. This was not my game plan. But it's bigger than that, too, because it was always really, really important to me when I had my kids, because my mother was so fantastic and because she made me feel loved every second of every day that I had her with me yeah. until I was 28. I really wanted that for my kids. I wanted my kids to just know that they were loved and they could do anything and they were supported. I needed that more than anything. Mm-hmm. That was a key thing. The other part of me was, again, like I said, but I didn't feel, I went from a little girl who felt like she could do anything to a woman who felt like she could do nothing and deserved nothing. And I didn't have my mother, I didn't have my brother to be there saying, you can do it, or you're special, or we I didn't have that mm-hmm. anymore. I had lost that. And without getting into too much, because say that for people who read it, but there was physical trauma that happened. And then my relationship took a turn. I was in a good marriage, and I'll leave that for the readers, but there was a change in my marriage, in my relationship. And suddenly I didn't feel loved or protected, cared about. Yeah. And I felt that the only thing, okay, so how can I find worth? Okay, I need to be the best mother I can, but I need to find a way to prove my worth to myself. And I felt at this point that it was through my body. It was through my sexuality. That's what I felt I had to offer. That's the only thing mm-hmm. I felt that I had to offer. And the eating disorder certainly didn't help with that, because I already had the pressure of feeling like I had to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. And then my husband and I had opened up our marriage sexually, and that had... It's an interesting theme because mm-hmm. without getting into detail, the first experience that we had changed everything for me because I felt very belittled. Mm-hmm. And,
okay. I know we can't give this away because I do want people to read the book, but your husband did ask you to do things, and things that a husband really is there to elevate you, right? Is to pedestalize you. But instead this was demeaning. Was there ever a point where you just said, no, I don't want to do this.
Okay. Well, first I want to be very clear. I was not forced into anything. I was not pushed into anything because I want to make that very clear. Yes, there were things that were brought up. I'm going to say, well, maybe 5 years in, there were some things that were, it's still really inopportune times after some major traumas that I went through. There were some suggestions. Why don't we do this? Or what? And I said, no, mm-hmm. not my thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I am open about, I've always been a sexual person, very comfortable in that. But also very one-on-one person, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. and still dealing with my body image stuff. So I wasn't one to kind of show myself off mm-hmm, to everybody mm-hmm. at all. So I said no, but then I went through more. And I often talk about how a therapist said I experienced traumatic overload, where it was almost like the straw that broke the camel's back, mm-hmm. where that was it. I had nothing. My body's like, you're done. You mm-hmm. can't fight anything anymore. You know, and I, again, because I didn't have a support system. It was just me. And I wasn't the best person to be leaning on mm-hmm. at this time. I wasn't the best for me. Mm-hmm. And so with my husband at the time, yes, he made another suggestion. I just had my second baby. I was going through something. I didn't feel like me. I knew I wasn't postpartum because I felt very connected with my children, but I felt different. And I knew I felt different. And there was a really open window there for him to kind of go, why don't we try? And again, you have to understand, I was feeling unloved mm-hmm. and unprotected. And the first thing he suggested was that I be with one of his friends.
And I wonder, did you feel, as I was reading this, that it created more intimacy and bonding between you and your husband because you were giving him something that he wanted or that he, you know, was enjoying? Like, was there part of it that you felt, this is helping my marriage, or not so much? I was just curious about that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's funny looking back because at the time, no, I don't, it wasn't this great bonding thing. I think some couples have that. I think at the time I did though, at one point, I think this is awesome. What a great thing. I mean, you can be married and you're not lying or cheating and you're getting to be with other people. How great is this? Mm-hmm. You know, and, but it wasn't actually great. But at the time I thought, but it showed, I think at that point, I mean, our marriage went on for so much longer after that, but I think the real clue for me was there was zero jealousy from the beginning, which is good, but also kind of
not
like,
good.
Huh, really?
Right? Not so good. Not so good. And there's a very poignant moment in the book where you're going to couples therapy with your husband, you go to a pub together to talk, and you say you remember the exact night you made the decision to not be married anymore. And I quote, I just looked at him and I said, I am done. Are you done? And he said, yeah, I think I'm done too. And even though you were relieved, there was this very sort of heartbreaking to read. You could feel your sadness, even though this is kind of what you wanted, but you felt very sad about all of this. Can you tell us more about that night and what ultimately gave you the courage to do it and how you felt when you finally really let go of something that had not really been very good for you? Don't answer that just yet. We're going to go on a short commercial break. More with Finding Your Bliss and Marcy Warhaf when we come back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio. And I was just asking you, Marcy, before the break about what gave you the courage ultimately to leave a marriage that hadn't really been good for you for a long time. What finally was the tipping point for you?
Well, I think we were together 24 years, and it was good at first. It really was. I always questioned commitment and things like that. I was always kind of didn't feel the way I thought I should feel and things like that. But we got along really, really well. We really did. At first, we were a great couple, and I did have high hopes for us. But I think that's where the sadness comes from. It's that even though things really, I joke that, you know, we were together 24 years, we had a good four and not in a row. Yeah. But there were moments there. There were times there when things were so good. And when I was ill, I talk about that experience when I was, and he was fantastic. And I will never, ever say anything different to that. He was fantastic. Yes. And so I think there was a time when I kind of think that we would have made really good friends, you know, at one point. I think we would have made really good friends. So that's where the sadness is. And it's like any kind of marriage, or especially when there's kids involved, you want things to work. But I'm somebody who will work at something. But when I'm done, and anyone who knows me now even knows, if I'm done, I'm done. I'm done. And we went to therapy, and I remember the therapist saying, I think Marcy's done. And like that. And I was, but I was able to look at him and say, I said to him, we did good. Like, even though there was a lot of not great stuff, we did a lot of good stuff. And especially raising these two incredible human beings that we've raised. Yeah. So I was able to sort of look past the craziness that had happened. And I think I saw in that moment when we were out together, I saw me at 24 getting married, and him at 26 getting married. And I saw that.
The hope and the love and all of the romance and the possibility, right?
And what we did, and I was able to somehow just see that part of it and not see the other stuff that came after. And so that's where the sadness is. And that's why I said, you know, I think sometimes in a relationship, people say that a successful relationship is one, they think it's one that lasts forever, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's successful when you can look at each other and go, we're done. We've done as much as we can do. And now it's time to let each other go. And that's how
the fact that you were able to create these two spectacular children and all of this good stuff and extract that, but know that this was not serving you well anymore. And the other thing that was not serving you well was the eating disorder. And you tried many different things, but finally there was an eating disorders group that you became part of. And I believe there were 8 or 10 women in a circle, and they all had anorexia. And at the time you were suffering from bulimia. So you weren't even like them. So you didn't even, again, it's so interesting, the theme running through of feeling different, feeling different, even in this group. It wasn't like you could relate to all of them. And part of you thought, I can't deal with this. This is, and then they gave you these lists that, there's a page in the book with the three columns of what you had to eat. And oh my God, there's one column. I was like ready to go have a chocolate bar. But anyway, it was so good. But you realized I have to stick with it, even though you wanted to flee, which you would have done in the past, but you knew you had to stick with it. What was it about that eating disorders program that made you stick to it and really triumph finally?
It was a fantastic program, but I think it's also where I was at that time, because you could have the best program and not be ready and it's not going to work. So it had to be the two things coming together, because I was on a waiting list, got the call, said, no, I don't need it. And then lost my place and had to go back. But I'll tell you what kept me there were my kids. I say all the time that I gave them life, but they saved mine. I had given up on myself. I had given up on my, I was done. I was exhausted. But I couldn't not be there for them. I didn't have a mom, and that was devastating. I needed to be there for them. And that's why I stuck with it. And it was great. And it was hard. And I couldn't pick them up from school 3 days a week because I would get home later. That was devastating for me because I was always there for them. Yes. I took them to school. I picked them up from school. I was there. But then I told myself I'm doing this for them. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to be the type of mother who, when I was with them, I was with them. I wasn't thinking about what I eat and what I was eating, what I was going to eat. I wasn't worrying about calories or fat grams. I wanted to be the best mother I could be. And I knew in order to do that, I had to stick with that program. And not only was I the only one who was overeating at the time, I was way older than everybody too. Yeah. So, I mean, it was so hard, but it was the best thing that I did. These are kids who would look at me and say to me when I was starving myself and say, are you eating today, mommy, or just watching? Mm-hmm. I didn't want that.
And then you have this scene where you're finally be able to eat a French fry or eat ice cream with them. And they got so much enjoyment of you just being able to be normal with them. And you have become a recognized expert on body image and self-esteem. You were even on the Geraldo Rivera show, even though that's a fascinating scene. You'll have to read it. But I have to ask you, how are you with it right now?
I'm super grateful for a strong recovery. I will tell you that my recovery, what I learned, isn't about getting up every morning and thinking, I love my body and I love how it looks. Well, no, that's not true. I do love my body, but you don't wake up every morning loving how I look. But my recovery, it doesn't matter how it looks or how I feel in it every day. It doesn't keep me from doing the things that I want to do. The difference is that I will never, ever, ever say I hate my body again. I will never not appreciate my body. I love my body. My body changes. It fluctuates all the time. And when I'm bigger, when I'm smaller, I will always appreciate what it does for me. It fights like crazy to keep me alive every day. And I have tested it. Oh boy, by giving it challenges.
Oh, your poem.
And it has survived.
I have to say there's a poem at the end of the book, and everyone, you have to read the book to hear this poem called My Body, but it's heart-wrenching. It made me cry. And it was just so beautiful. That poem is so beautiful. And I also love that when you're dancing in that poem at the end, it's the dancing you did as a young girl, just dancing it out, having that escape, having that refuge, having that, just that catharsis of what it feels like when you just dance to great music, sometimes by yourself with a hairbrush and sing and dance and all
every
of that.
Day.
And that was, that poem just is so incredibly beautiful.
I just want to say with that poem, I actually wrote that poem years before I wrote the book.
Really?
I didn't even know I was writing the book. And then when I wrote the book, I thought, I think that's going to fit in.
That's really cool. What is the most important message that you want people to take home from this book?
Truth. I think that do not let fear keep you from being everything that you want to be. Do not let fear of other people's expectations. We say that all the time. Let the shame go. Forgive yourself. As I said in my book, forgive yourself for the mistakes you made when you were doing your best to survive. Let shame go. Don't be ashamed of anything you've done to get you to this point. Be proud of who you are and move forward with that.
I love that. And with regards to body image, which you say, and we all know, it is so hard when you look at images everywhere on social media, in magazines, in newspapers, in movies of the perfect idealized. How have you reconciled all of that? And what can you tell people about body image and what you've learned through a lot of pain and suffering and ultimately, I think, some freedom?
I think it's a lot of self-talk, I would say. I still do a lot. I talk to myself more than I talk to anybody. I think what I keep telling myself often, it's hard not to judge ourselves, but we really do judge ourselves so much more than other people do. And what I've learned, we are so hard on ourselves, and it's because we will focus on every tiny little thing. I will know if I have if I feel like I've gained a quarter of a pound since yesterday, I will feel, you're not going to see it. People see all of you. When they look at you, they're not looking at the little flaw that you see. They are seeing you. And when you are happy and when you're free and when you're just who you are, that is the most attractive thing. We have to get out of our heads and realize that we are so much more than our bodies. We are so much more than that. And to celebrate who you are. I know it sounds so flippant, but honestly, we don't give enough credit to, I've learned that I am no more interesting, feisty, sexy, funny when I'm heavier than when I'm smaller, when I'm smaller than when I'm heavier. My love for my body is not conditional on how much the scale says. Mm-hmm. It's not. And I think we have to stop being so conditionally loving to our bodies, because who we are as amazing at whatever size pants we're wearing. It doesn't matter. It's to appreciate and understand that we are worthy at whatever. We're going to change, and that's okay, you know, but we can be as badass now as we are 20 years from now, 20 sizes from now. Who cares? That's just, it's so unimportant.
Would you say the book has helped you be in a much better place? And are you in a good place right now?
It absolutely helped me, because once I put it all out there, I don't second guess what I think, what I say, what I do, as far as what other people are going to think. I mean, once you get all your secrets out, there's no more shame. Nobody can shame you for something you're not ashamed of. So this is the most me I have ever been. Now, good or bad, you know, I'm tempted to ask, but this is absolutely the most me. And that's all I wanted. I wanted to get to, you know, I don't know how many years I have left, hopefully plenty, but I knew that I wanted to get there being comfortable in my skin. And I spent so many decades not being comfortable in my skin. And so now it's not perfect. I've got a lot to learn. I still have so much more to learn and to grow and to be. However, I'm finally okay with me. And you'd be amazed at what a life changer it is when you're okay with who you are.
Beautiful. There's a question that we ask everyone at the end of the show. And so of course I'm going to ask it to you. What is bliss for Marcy Warhaft?
Oh, well, dancing. Everybody knows that when I'm free in my body, when I'm dancing with music and losing myself in music, that's bliss for me.
That's great. Maybe you should have gone to dance instead of to theater school. Maybe there's still...
I taught dance forever. I know I should. I did. I taught dance forever. I volunteer now at a special needs school.
That's fantastic.
Teaching dance. It's awesome.
Would you ever want to revisit the actor part of you, the actress?
I would. I don't know how to get into it now, but I would.
You need to hire a life coach like me and I can help you. What is the best way for people to contact you and to connect with you on social media? And of course, to get a copy of this really incredible book, The Good Stripper, A Soccer Mom's Memoir of Lies, Loss, and Lap Dances.
Well, I'm very easy to find. You can find me all over social media. It's just my name, Marcy Warhaft, on Facebook and Instagram and even some TikTok. And email me at marcywarhaft@rogers.com, marcywarhaft.com. I do some resiliency coaching. But also, if you read my book and you want to talk about it, message me. I'm easy to find. You can find my book at Amazon, Indigo, and as an audiobook on Audible. I think I've covered it all.
That's great. Each week, we spotlight a fabulous person like Marcy Warhaft, who's living their bliss. So if you're an author, artist, yoga, meditation, or mindfulness expert, or really anyone who has found and is following their bliss, we would love to hear from you. As you also know, I love to feature singers, songwriters, and musicians on the show. So if you're that as well, reach out to me at fyb@findingyourbliss.com. And for those of you who don't know, I'm the Bliss Coach. That means I help people get unstuck, gain clarity, and help people find their passion and purpose. Reach out to me at findingyourbliss.com/coaching. I'm also on Insight Timer, the number one free meditation app. And of course, you can always follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. I would like to thank our wonderful guest, Marcy Warhaft, for being on the show today. Also, thank you to Meg Ruffman, Siobhan Kiley, producer Olivia Weatherall, audio engineer Juliana Yannizziello, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. For everyone here, I'm Judy Lee Brack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.